The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Black Mass has raked in more than $60 million at the box office. The film, based on investigative work by two Boston Globe reporters, stars Johnny Depp as James Whitey Bulger, the ruthless criminal who ruled Boston's Irish mob for decades. Bulger was enlisted as an informant and shielded from investigation by FBI agent and Saudi neighbor John Connolly. In this scene, Connolly, played by Joel Edgerton, has just shared some key information with Bulger.
John, do you know what I do to rats?
It ain't rat, Jimmy. It's an alliance.
An alliance between me and the FBI.
No, between you and me. I can help you, Jimmy, and you can help me.
Every year, the government makes thousands of deals with criminal offenders in exchange for information. From housing projects to college campuses to state prisons to international drug rings, these deals are instrumental in investigating and prosecuting crooks. Our guest, Alexandra Nadipoff, acknowledges these important law enforcement victories, but is concerned about the largely informal and secretive process of rewarding informants who may be serious criminals themselves. Alexandra Nadipoff is professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and author of Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, also author of the snitching.org blog. Professor Nadipoff, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this so-called unholy alliance between Boston crime boss Whitey Bulger, perhaps one of the best criminal informant cases we know about, is it typical of how the FBI operates with criminal informants?
Well, so the Whitey Bulger story, of course, has captured the imagination not only now of moviegoers, but of Congress, of the FBI, of the Department of Justice. It really was an extreme example of the FBI going overboard in not just rewarding, but protecting and shielding a very serious offender in exchange for information. And that's really at the heart of all informant deals. A criminal informant is just someone who trades information or cooperation with the government in exchange for leniency for themselves. It could be criminal suspects, someone who hasn't been arrested, has already been arrested, has already been charged, even someone who's already incarcerated. And as you pointed out earlier, we do this thousands of times in our criminal justice system. It's a staple of law enforcement. It's a staple of investigation. And Whitey Bulger, for all the drama, is a great conversation starter, but in a way it masks just how common and run-of-the-mill this practice really is.
Well, he was protected by agents that he actually corrupted, John Connolly and his boss, John Morris. Who is it that oversees these kind of deals?
In some ways, that's the million-dollar question. Let's take the Whitey Bulger story for a moment. So when the debacle came to light, the Department of Justice reacted by creating new guidelines for the FBI, basically saying you can't run your informants in the same unfettered, unaccountable way that you have been. Now you're going to have to start keeping track. And so the Department of Justice Attorney General guidelines for the use of FBI confidential human sources, that's the name of the document, tells the FBI how they need to manage their CIs. They need to keep track of what they do. They need to have complete files on them. They need to keep track of rewards and benefits that they might get. And they need to keep track of the crimes that they commit, both authorized and unauthorized, because, of course, one of the great risks of the use of criminal informants is that it entails, by its very nature, the government turning a blind eye to informant crime. And so these days, the FBI has, in many ways, as a result of the Whitey Bulger debacle, some of the most extensive guidelines for the use of CIs. On the other hand, those guidelines and the use of those informants is still highly secretive from the outside. For example, Congress, the legislators who oversee our criminal justice system and write the laws, have no way of getting information about those decisions. And then as you move down into the states and counties and local jurisdictions, it gets even worse.
John Connolly was sentenced to 40 years, the former FBI agent. Whitey Bulger now serving two life sentences, been charged with racketeering, drug trafficking, extortion, 11 murders. Do we have clear evidence that CIs do regularly break the law?
Not only do we have clear evidence, it's well understood that within law enforcement that sometimes the best CIs are the ones that are the most serious and active criminals. As the saying goes, if you want to catch the devil, you can't rely on angels as witnesses. It's kind of a rationale for using serious offenders. And so we see time and time again, very serious offenders, whether they're drug dealers, whether they're cartel members, whether they are violent offenders, who are able to escape punishment for their crimes and even indeed continue to commit them because they have cut a deal with the government and have made themselves useful.
How about the value of criminal informants in helping law enforcement? They can infiltrate circles that law enforcement would not normally have access to. Are you against the use of CIs at all, or just figuring out a way to regulate which cases are justified?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it. It's really figuring out what's the best way to understand and regulate this risky public policy. And you're absolutely right. CIs have their place. There are some kinds of institutions, some kinds of crimes that it's very difficult for law enforcement to penetrate and get information about without compensating a criminal informant, witness, or source. And when we look at our criminal justice system, we get to ask, and we should get to ask, under what circumstances is that worth it, right? So Congress, when it finally got the information about Whitey Bulger and the many other people like him, Whitey Bulger was not the only violent, serious offender that the FBI was using. They issued a scathing report called Everything Secret Degenerates, the FBI's Use of Murderers as criminal informants, in effect making a legislative judgment that the FBI had gone too far. But there may be cases where it's worth forgiving a very serious offender in exchange for information. So one of my favorite examples is Jack Abramoff, right? Maybe your listeners remember Abramoff was a corrupt lobbyist.
Yeah.
In Washington, D.C., and he was the poster boy for sort of the erosion of democratic principles. They passed an Abramoff law trying to improve ethics on Capitol Hill. And when he was finally caught facing 30 years in prison for his crimes, ultimately he ended up doing four. Why? Because he cooperated, because he gave information about a congressman and about aides on Capitol Hill. We could have a debate, a public debate, in which reasonable minds could differ over whether that was worth it. But we don't get to have that debate in this country because we almost never get to find out what those deals are, what the true costs are, as well as the benefits.
We're talking about how law enforcement uses criminal informants, or CIs, with Professor Alexandra Nadapa from Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. She also tracks litigation and legislation informing CIs and tracks crimes and wrongful convictions based on use of informants at her blog, snitching.org. You mentioned thousands of CIs currently in use. Any idea of a precise count there?
It's very hard to get an account because we don't require the government to keep track. We know that it's pervasive because law enforcement tells us that it's pervasive. For example, in the war on drugs, law enforcement tells us often that every drug case involves a snitch in one way or another. Well, that's one-third of state and federal dockets. And then that model has spread. There's no federal crime that a defendant cannot work off by informing, by cooperating. The U.S. Sentencing Commission tells us that in every single type of crime, the government has made it a practice to award credit or cooperation benefits to individuals who have informed, who have cooperated, from murder to child pornography to drug dealing. But no, we don't have definitive data on how many informants there are, what kind of deals they're getting, how many crimes they're helping us solve, right? The million-dollar question, how effective is it? And then, of course, the equally important question, how much crime are we tolerating in exchange for this information?
Well, and you also chart on your blog the danger to some of these criminal informants. Rachel Hoffman, college student, became an informant in Tallahassee, Florida, killed when police sent her on a dangerous sting. How do we establish reliability and accuracy and ability of the informants to actually do the work of the government?
So if you look at Whitey Bulger, the informant problem looks like a problem of serious crime being tolerated by the government, because that's, you know, the great failure of the Whitey Bulger case. In a very different vein, sometimes we pressure vulnerable people, young people, people with substance abuse problems, into becoming informants. In a way, it's the opposite of Whitey Bulger, who manipulated the government and exploited his relationship with the government in order to do terrible things. But sometimes we permit our government to manipulate and exploit informants. And you mentioned an infamous case of a young woman named Rachel Hoffman in Florida, who, for a very low-level drug offense, was pressured into becoming an informant and then sent on a very dangerous sting during which she was killed. And as a result of her death, her family's efforts and lobbying efforts, Florida passed a law called Rachel's Law that required police in Florida for the very first time to consider, not to limit the police's ability to create informants, but merely to consider certain factors before they turn people into informants. For example, how young is this person? Do they have a substance abuse problem or a mental health problem? Have they ever had any contact with violent or serious offenses? Or would it be a huge leap for them to become an informant because they're inexperienced and unable to defend themselves? So Florida, so far, is the only state to require all its police departments to have regulations like that. But it's the kind of problem, in a way, that's masked when we focus on the Whitey Bulgers.
You know, obviously a huge case in law enforcement, but also post-law enforcement and convictions, very big issue among inmates in jail informing on other people. So let's look at the other side of this. Those who are convicted, are there clear cases that you have tracked of wrongful convictions based on faulty information from CIs?
So looked at from another perspective, some folks think that the most dangerous thing about informant use is their unreliability. And remember what an informant is. An informant is essentially a paid criminal witness, someone who is working off their own sentence, their own potential liability, in exchange for giving information. And because the temptation to fabricate or twist the truth is so great under those circumstances, and because, frankly, law enforcement has not been good about going after lying informants, there's almost no downside to fabricating or lying. And so we see it all the time. There was a well-known report issued a few years ago by Northwestern University Law School, at their Center on Wrongful Convictions. And that report looked at all the wrongful capital convictions, the wrongful death penalty convictions that we know about. And they looked at why innocent people ended up on death row. And the report concluded that the single largest source of error, over 45% of the wrongful death penalty convictions that we know about, were a result of a jury believing a lying criminal informant who was testifying in exchange for a deal.
Let me just look at the whole concept of snitching as we wrap up here. I mean, to the end, Whitey Bulger insisted that he was never a rat. You know, there's this criminal code of ethics. But even from an early age, we are taught to abhor a tattletale. What do you think is going on in this sort of psychological makeup of snitching?
You know, I think the world of snitching is so enormous and complex that we see so many ways in which people end up giving information to the government for different reasons. They may do it because they're a criminal mastermind like Whitey Bulger, or they may do it because they're a young, frightened drug addict who sees no way out. I think the heart of the matter, for whatever reasons that people end up becoming informants, the heart of the matter is that we have permitted our government to create a market, an underground, off-the-record kind of black market, if you will, in which everyone understands that liability and information can be traded. And it's a threat to so many aspects of the integrity of our criminal justice system. It threatens its transparency. It threatens its fairness. It threatens its reliability. And it's that market that we need to worry about. For whatever reasons people enter it, we need to worry about the threat that that trade, that those deals pose to very important pillars of our criminal justice system.
Professor Nadipov, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Again, thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Nadipov, she's professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and author of Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, also the snitching.org blog. And you'll find more information on the book and a link to the blog at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about how some criminal informants stay out of prison even while committing crimes, sometimes with the full knowledge and protection of law enforcement. Well, now we're going to hear about a woman who, according to human rights advocates, had been behind bars far longer than necessary. Devin Strolovich produced this story in 2009. Afterwards, we'll give you an update on what's happened since.
Deborah Piegler is an inmate at the Central California Women's Facility at Chowchilla, where she used to lead the church choir.
She is a 49-year-old woman, mother of two, grandmother of three, who has been incarcerated for the last 27 years for her involvement in the death of her batter.
Nadia Costa and Joshua Safran are Piegler's pro bono attorneys.
Deborah never got a trial, and she never got to tell her story about how she had been taken at the age of 15 by a drug dealer. She took a plea. She took a plea to first-degree murder and took a sentence of 25 years to life.
Of course, this was back in the 80s, South Central Los Angeles, where there was not a lot of faith in the ability of the police to maintain law. All she could think of was, I just want to make this pain stop.
Costa and Safran got involved with Piegler's case in January 2003. Through the California Habeas Project.
The Habeas Project is a statewide coalition of agencies working together to ensure access to a new law that allows women who were battered and never had an opportunity to present expert evidence of the effects of that battering to go back to court and try and get a new trial.
Basically, everyone who's reviewed her case has agreed that she should be released. At worst, Debbie's crime was voluntary manslaughter, which would have put her in for a maximum of 6 years. But Debbie's still in prison, and Debbie's still waiting to have her evidentiary hearing.
By all accounts, Debbie Piegler has been an exemplary inmate. The dysfunctions in the prison system have been especially frustrating for her and her attorneys.
Everything is a battle. And everything that in the outside world should move relatively smoothly is going to be a roadblock when you're in prison.
But no one could have anticipated the degree of failure Piegler experienced in the prison's medical system.
We were finally, after years of pursuing justice through the legal system, we're getting very close, and then we learned that she's been diagnosed with an advanced case of lung cancer that has apparently spread to her heart and her spine and her liver, and she has only months to live.
Costa says Piegler's medical care was below substandard.
She had complained for months of significant symptoms, not being able to breathe, huge protrusions on her neck, never received care, only received the ability to go out and be seen by a doctor when they received a threatening letter from our law firm stating that they have to get her out. And at that time, she was given that diagnosis, left without a treating doctor, left without a treatment plan, left without any sort of prognosis, which she then remained for weeks in this sort of limbo without any concern.
A 2005 finding by a federal judge found that a California inmate dies needlessly every 6 to 7 days.
Attorney Joshua Safran.
Fundamental and basic provision of women's health, including basic preventative medicine, pap smears, mammograms, that kind of thing, have simply not been provided.
To get the most basic of care, the basic level of humanity to occur, it's a fight every day.
Debbie Pegler's own Fight for Humanity produced a tentative victory in July 2009 at her sixth parole board hearing.
The panel reviewed all information received from the public and all relevant information that is before us today, concluding that the prisoner is suitable for parole and would not pose an unreasonable risk of danger to society or threat to public safety for release from prison.
Watching Debbie finally have an acknowledgement of what she has done in prison, what she has learned, the importance of her not staying in prison any longer, and the importance of being with her family at this time. That moment in and of itself was tremendously valuable to her.
And at this point, it's a race against time to try to get her out so that she can spend her last moments with her family, see the stars at night one time, and hear the sound of the ocean at least one time before she dies.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Devin Strolovich.
And that story on Deborah Pegler was produced in the summer of 2009. About a month after, Deborah was finally released from prison. She died of lung cancer in June of 2010.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2012 was a rough year for comedian Tig Notaro. She was in and out of the hospital with an infection. Her mother died suddenly. She broke up with her long-term girlfriend. And the kicker? She was diagnosed with cancer. In October, she walked onto stage for her regular gig at Largo in Los Angeles and began her act.
Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi. How are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God.
And with that startling personal admission, her career took off. A documentary team filmed her undergoing treatment for stage 2 breast cancer. Now 44, after a double mastectomy, she's back on the road, out with a TV special and writing a memoir. She's also the subject of the Netflix documentary Tig, which is streaming now. Her HBO stand-up special Boyish Girl Interrupted is also available at HBO Go. I spoke with her just before she filmed that set in Boston. Tig Notaro, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Knock Knock. It's Tig Notaro. So the premise is that people send in submissions for you to come and perform in their hometowns or even their homes or backyards. You got more than 1,000 submissions. How did you decide where to go?
Well, I've done the tour previously, and this was the first time it was filmed for release in any way. And the way I've always done it is just to have an idea of a route that I want to go on and then take all submissions and then really focus on the area that I have in mind, but then kind of allow myself the freedom to go to a different town or veer outside of the tour that I've scheduled beforehand.
So you did go to southern Indiana. You go to Pluto, Mississippi. Now, you were born in Mississippi, I guess, and raised outside of Houston, yeah?
Yeah, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi, and then we moved down to the Gulf Coast to Pass Christian, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Spring, Texas, which is a smaller town outside of Houston.
Now, you dropped out of high school. Did you know then you wanted to be a comedian?
No, I pretty much just knew I did not want to be in school. I failed 3 grades and dropped out. And I mean, I was definitely the mischievous class clown in school, but I didn't really know. I loved stand-up as a kid, and I followed it and listened to records and stuff, but I just I didn't know for sure, I think, until I was in my early 20s.
Well, I guess you were kind of doing your bit or establishing your bona fides because a lot of comedians began as miscreants, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I always, whenever I'm hanging out with my friends in Los Angeles, I always refer to everyone as the land of misfit toys from, you know, those claymation shows.
Right. From the Santa Claus is coming
to
town.
Yeah.
Right. So what's the appeal for you as a performer playing to these little stages? I mean, I thought that once you get big, you don't perform for 9 people anymore.
Well, I appreciate that you think I'm big. I don't know. I think there's comedy is always great in awkward and unsafe environments. And I think that that's kind of a way that you can get back to that, because walking into a comedy club when you're a known comedian or you have a very worked out show, it is a pretty safe ride. But when you are working out new material or you have no material, which is what happened to me on that tour, I had no new material. I relied on a few old jokes in that taping, but in general, I was trying to get my feet wet again after having old material and then announcing that I had cancer in this show a couple of years ago. And then it kind of cleaned my slate with material when I got back out, I was like, God, I really don't have anything. And so it puts you into that unsafe, exciting environment, being in someone's living room.
It sounds terrifying to me.
It is. Trust me.
And
but
awkward.
It's also exhilarating.
Yeah, is it? So do you feel like you've come away from that experience with what?
I can't wait to do it again.
Really?
Yeah. I hope it turns into a TV show down the road.
But you used to be known anyway as a deadpan comic, not offering a lot of clues about who you are. And then this, after initially announcing that you had cancer at that show at Largo.
Oh, my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation. Oh, it's fine. Here's what happened. It's very personal. Found a lump. Guys, relax. Everything's fine. I have cancer.
I'm thinking of those hours beforehand. I mean, did you decide you were going to do this? Did you rehearse it? What happened?
Well, I had several days. I was diagnosed on July 25th, and the show was August 3rd. And so I spent those days just reflecting on how I felt. And I had originally wanted to cancel the show, but the owner of the club suggested I just keep the show and see how I felt right up to the last second. And if I didn't want to do it, I could cancel. So I kept it on the books, and then I just kept writing and seeing how I felt. And I knew that I couldn't have, because aside from cancer, I'd also, my mother died unexpectedly after an accident, and I was in the middle of a breakup, and I had another illness where I couldn't eat food. I was really at rock bottom. And so I could not bring myself to get on stage with a cancer diagnosis and, you know, a skeletal frame of a body and just be like, oh, my gosh. So I was traveling the other day, you know, and just make lighthearted jokes. I felt like I had something massive staring me in the face, and I needed to acknowledge it and hopefully make light of it. And so, and yeah, it wasn't my typical style, but before I walked on stage, I was so nervous because I knew I was about to do something I had never done and that I had no clue how it was going to go. And, so the safety was definitely gone there.
He made huge news. Louis C.K., among others, praised your set. He said it was one of the few truly masterful sets he'd ever seen. People talk about you on stage. I'm wondering what you saw in the audience as you were looking out.
I mean, it was such a mix of confused people waiting for the punchline, and just shock and awkward laughter. And then the more I kept talking about things, the more it became clear that it wasn't a joke. It was just really a setup of, you know, truth so that I could explore all the different aspects of what I was going through and make light of it. And once people started to realize it was true, I also saw people crying in the audience, and it was really a mixed bag to look out into. And it was also a reality check, letting me know that this was really happening. It was kind of hard to comprehend everything. Very surreal moments that I would go in and out of.
And now when you hear those clips of you doing that, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you feel like...
Oh. I don't listen to those clips. I mean, honestly, if somebody's playing it in an interview or... And it's not just from that show that it's hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to anything of myself. I really can't think of anything worse than hearing myself. And it's not like, oh, that this is such a hard time and painful time. It's just, oh my gosh, I can't hear myself. I used to listen to myself when I was first starting out as a stand-up, and I would record all my shows. And even now when I'm working out new material, I'll sometimes record the audio. But I always think it's a funny sight if somebody walked in and heard me listening to my audio, because I'm telling jokes. You hear the audience laughing, and my face is very stoic and serious listening. My face does not look like I understand comedy at all when I'm listening very intently.
Tig Notaro is a stand-up comedian and soon-to-be memoirist, and you can catch her latest stand-up special, Boyish Girl Interrupted, on HBO Go. She's also the subject of the documentary Tig, which is now streaming on Netflix. Do people now who have cancer seek you out? I mean, do they think you're kind of the cancer comic, the one who's been through it?
I don't know what people think, but I certainly get quite the mix of people at my shows, from podcast fans that listen to my podcast, comedy nerds, and cancer survivors, and just every person across the board. And it's really an interesting mix of people. People that have just had a bad day and listened to my show from 2012, had a bad day at the office, and they were like, wow, that really put things into perspective for me. And so I don't know what brings people to me, but I know it seems to be, you know, from casting a wide net through all the different avenues I've taken along the way.
How are you doing now? How's your health?
I always say, as far as I know, it's really good. I'm actually going to my oncologist in a couple hours, and I'm 3 years of no evidence of disease.
Wow.
Which is
hooray.
Terrific.
People who cheat death often have an air of invincibility. How about you? Did it embolden you to try new things? I mean, you're writing a memoir now. There is just a documentary about you, this television documentary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I've always tried new things, and I've gone out on a limb, and I think I didn't realize that until I saw the completed documentary about my life. It's supposed to be coming out this summer.
And right, this called, is Tig?
Yeah, it's called Tig. And after I watched the movie, I was like, wow, I take chances. Mm. And I take serious risks. And I didn't realize that about my personality. But I think more than risks that are gigantic, I think cheating death makes me more of somebody more open to be celebrating daily things and anniversaries, birthdays, just any celebratory moment. Or I was writing about this in my book yesterday about how as a child I got soaps, a little box of soaps that were in the shape of combs and brushes and mirrors, and they seemed too special to ever use. And so I never used them. And then I don't ever know where they went. And I was just reflecting on how I should have just, the day I got them when I was five, I should have gotten in the bathtub and used them. And I think there's more of that feeling of, I'm going to use the soaps that come in the shape of a hand brush or a mirror, you know.
You know, I've heard this expression, it's not what happens to you, it's what you do with it. And I couldn't help but think that, listening to the tape of you talking about having cancer after this year of unbelievable shock and grief.
Four months. Yeah.
Compact time of shock and grief and ill health. But looking back at it, I mean, would you do this any differently? Would you have treated that? Would you have kept it private?
No. I was already private. And this is what blew the doors off of privacy and making me realize that it helped me to communicate. It helps every situation to be open and vulnerable and communicative. And every door opened in my personal life, my love life, my career, my family, my friends. There's rarely any time in life where you withhold and really see a payoff.
Tig Notaro, thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
Tig Notaro is a stand-up comedian and soon-to-be memoirist, and you can catch her latest stand-up special, Boyish Girl Interrupted, on HBO Go. She's also the subject of the documentary Tig, which is now streaming on Netflix. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The specter of cancer looms large in our minds, and yet tumors themselves remain largely invisible to the people who have them. Producer Eric Malinsky brings us the story of an artist who sought to better understand her disease by turning an intangible diagnosis into physical art.
In 2008, Leonor Caraballo was diagnosed with breast cancer. From the moment the doctor said the word cancer, everything was a blur.
I realized a year later, after I went through the whole cancer management, that I had no idea what they were talking about. I hadn't seen this tumor. I knew it wanted to kill me, but I didn't really understand what it meant.
Now, Leonor is an artist. She needs to process things visually. So she asked the radiologist to give her pictures of the MRI scans. Each scan is a different cross-section of the tumor, like a slice of cake.
You know, there's thousands of slices. So I just looked at each and every one, different angles. And I kept on wanting to see it. I wanted to see it as an object. I wanted to take it basically out of the breast. I wanted to do what the surgeon did with the double mastectomy. I wanted to do that artistically.
She wanted to build a 3D model of her tumor, something she could hold in her hands. The first step was to create a 3D model on the computer, and then a 3D printer would take that blueprint and build a plastic model. It wasn't easy.
The MRI images everything, right? So all the tissue, all the vessels, and the tumor is kind of there with a slightly different shading.
Abu Farman is Leonor's husband and creative partner.
The 3D printer can't print everything. First of all, it'll just go nuts. So it either do surface.
And it would take 3 months to
print. We don't want to just print the surface of a breast. So the first thing was, digitally, how do you just isolate that thing?
And once they isolated that thing in the computer, the 3D printer was like, I can't print this thing. I mean, you know, if the printer could talk. The tumor was a weird blobby shape with very thin tentacles shooting outward. The artist had to work very closely with a computer technician.
We were, you know, in a way using this extremely high-tech process and then taking it all the way back to
the Bronze Age.
Back to the Bronze Age.
Lost wax and Bronze Age.
Actually, they took it to a foundry in Queens where the plastic model was cast in bronze. Now Leonor wears a little bronze tumor around her neck.
For me, it's a reminder that I hate the word survivor, but that I'm here and this thing is out of my body, and you know, and I feel more powerful than it.
It means it stopped growing. Okay, that's how it was. That's the final form it
took. That's how
it
was removed, and it's this final form it took, and it's not going to move anymore. It's not going to spread.
But they wanted to make more. So Michelle Drottman, a radiologist at Cornell Medical Center, gave them MRI scans of tumors from different women.
It's just amazing how different it looks outside the breast.
And how different the tumors look from each other. Some look like rock candy, others look like a piece of coral or a meteorite.
And that's what cancers usually are. They're not these nice, smooth lesions. They're ugly.
They're aggressive by nature.
Cancers don't follow tissue planes like benign things, which kind of respect the tissue. Tumors just grow, you know, wherever they want.
The couple created a company called Object Breast Cancer. Women can order paperweights, amulets, or worry beads based on their own MRI scans. Or they can order sculptures based on tumors from anonymous women. One of their first customers was Paula de la Cruz. She still cringes when she thinks about the moment the nurse gave her the results.
She handed me the paper and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for the bad news." I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea.
She turned to her friend, Leonor Caraballo, who recommended a surgeon and a radiologist. And then eventually, Leonor sculpted a paperweight based on Paula's tumor. Now Paula's in remission, but she likes having a physical reminder that sits on a stack of bills.
When I was going through the whole healing process, you know, chemotherapy, etc., you know, people use this war, you know, tones like, you gotta beat this, blah, blah. And I always felt it's my body that's chaotic and that's making these cells that are out of control. I mean, how are you at war with your own body?
You're monumentalizing illness.
I talked with the art critic Patty Johnson. She's a blogger who writes for Art Review and Art in America.
I think if you believe that, like, making this thing into a solid object that doesn't move is going to empower you, then obviously, yes, it is empowering. Would I feel that way? No.
Artwork that deals with illness, like AIDS or cancer, can put critics in a very difficult position.
I feel like I'm being a jerk right now, and that doesn't feel good. I mean, you asked me to talk about, like, to bring my background and my knowledge to this, and so that's what I have to do. It's part of my job.
Now, typically, art that deals with illness is fairly abstract. And this work is painstakingly literal, which is why Patty Johnson doesn't like it.
From a fine art perspective, we would look at the narrative that this work produces, and we would look at the metaphors, and we would say, you know, these metaphors are really obvious. They're a little too concrete. You know, I do wish that it looked a little more dangerous, something that looked otherworldly and a little less like things we already know.
Like a piece of coral or a rock formation.
Then it falls into another genre of art that I like to call invisible history art. So that's when the object doesn't speak to you until you're aware of the backstory.
But that backstory made the sculptures really interesting for Dr. Alexander Swistel. He removed the tumors from Leonor Caraballo and Paula de la Cruz. And then suddenly there they were, scaled up, cast in bronze, and sitting in an art gallery.
To actually see it in front of you, and then to actually pick up the sculpture and run your fingers over it and just understand, this is something that I took out. As a surgeon, it was a huge surprise.
Remember the tentacles and the tumors that made it so hard for the artist to build 3D models? Well, in real life, they were misleading Dr. Swistel. They were making him think that the tumors were actually bigger than they were.
We kind of thought to ourselves, well, wait a minute. So maybe we've been going at the treatment all wrong.
So as part of an experiment, he's working with a radiologist, Michelle Drotman, to create 3D models of tumors in the computer, just like the artists. The doctors are going to decide how much radiation to give patients based on the volume of their tumors, not just the widest dimensions.
Making therapeutic decisions based on three-dimensional volume measurements has just never been, to my knowledge, done at all in any kind of setting of any kind of tumor, but certainly for breast cancer.
And clinical trials are underway. He predicts that some of his patients may end up getting less chemotherapy, and maybe none at all.
And that story was produced by Eric Malinsky. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.